The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. Okay, so there are probably another five seats in here. People seem so far away out there. If you want to come in, you can come in. Or we make space here on the floor for you too, if you'd like. So after the talk today at 11:15, we're going to have this community meeting to talk about our new retreat center. It's a it's a momentous occasion for us to be opening this retreat center. We spent probably more. Chris Clifford and I probably first started planning for this about 9 years ago. About 9 years ago. And her karma is catching up to her. And me. we're quite lucky to have this come to fruition now. And we are putting together, creating a retreat center that's very different than the retreat centers that our tradition mostly knows about, a different way, a different model for how to have retreat practice, how to have a community around a retreat practice place. And so I think many of us are quite inspired and excited by what we have and what we're creating. And if you're interested in learning more about what this is about and what we're making up, what we're creating, this is what the meeting is at 11:15. Kind of a unique thing that we're starting from scratch. We have a blank slate in terms of how to put on retreats, how to organize a retreat center, and so it felt very important for me not to unconsciously or to go along with the models we've already have. Just this is how it has to be. So a lot of thought and care has gone into the model that we're going to have. So anyway. So for this morning, it's a little bit of a follow-up from last Sunday morning's talk, where I talked about one aspect of the Buddha's teachings on action and how the Buddha felt that how a person is measured is by their action, how they behave, what they do. In particular, he was concerned for in his path for the actions or the qualities of mental action that involves a purified mind, a mind or heart which is not caught up in greed, hate, or delusion. So following that, there's a discourse in the same collection, Discourse 61 in the middle-length discourse, which is quite touching, I think, because it's one of the earliest accounts or of how the Buddha was teaching his own son. And many people don't know that Buddha was a father, and from the time he kind of left his family, he did leave his family, in order to pursue his training that he took. Not unlike many people who sometimes have important things they need to do in their lives and end up leaving. And then when after he had finished his training and became enlightened, he went back to his home country, to home. And at that point, that period on, he became the primary parent of his child, of his son, who was 7 at the time. And this story here is about the very simple teachings the Buddha gave to his son. The tradition holds that his son is about 7 years old at this point. So his son had so you can imagine, a little bit a young child who's being taught by his father. And it's about action, about how to look at your action, consider your action, what kind of actions you act on. So it was evening. To set the scene, it was evening, and Rahula, the son, the Buddha's son, was staying with his father at this grove, this park-like setting that was kind of his monastery. And the evening, the Buddha got up from meditation and went to find his son. And when his son saw his father coming in the distance, he prepared a seat for him, which was the custom back then. You know, they were sitting outdoors under trees. They would sometimes make a clearing or bunch up some grass, or maybe put out a sitting cloth, or I don't know exactly what they did, but they would prepare a seat. And he also got out a bowl of water, which to this day, in some places in the world, like I think, I don't know if in India, but I experienced this when I was a monk in Burma, that you'd walk through the streets as a monk, barefoot, dusty, dirty streets, and you go to someone's home, and they would have a bowl of water ready for you at the entryway, and you would wash your feet, so you wouldn't be tracking in all this. So Rahula prepared a seat for his father, and prepared a bowl of water for him. And the Buddha came, and he washed his feet, and then he sat down. And then when he'd washed his feet, he left a little bit of water in that bowl. You know, so there was, he'd washed his feet, probably rinsed them out, but he left a little water left in there. And the first thing he said to Rahula, "Rahula, do you see this little water left in the bowl?" "Yes, venerable sir." I probably didn't call your father that. Or your kid. You that. "Yes, venerable sir." So here comes, you know, the first kind of strong statement. Even so little, Rahula, is the monkhood of those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie." So what happened? Your father sits you down in the evening and says, you know, because Rahula is a kind of novice monk by then, that the monkhood of someone who tells a deliberate lie is less than this little bit of water in this bowl of water. So it doesn't seem that the father is angry, you know, particularly. It's not like he's coming and chiding his son, but he sits down and says this to him. And the assumption of the tradition ever since is Rahula had said a lie. And so his father was going to talk to him about that. And probably some of you, as children, might have almost told a lie. And perhaps there was an occasion for your parents to sit you down and talk to you about this. Some of you probably have uncomfortable memories of how that went. Some of you perhaps it was maybe meaningful, maybe very important how that went. I had an occasion, well, I didn't lie, but I took the keys to the car. And when I was 14, and crashed the car into a bulldozer. Because I didn't know how to lie. I didn't know how to lie, but I didn't know how to drive. So I called up my father and said, at work, and called, you know your car. And so he very matter-of-factly said, "Well, what happened to it?" And I said, "Well, we crashed into the right side of the car, crashed into the bulldozer, and we only went about 4 feet. You know, we didn't know how to drive, so we were kind of both parked there." And so he said, "Well," I said, "Well, now we can't open the right-hand door." And so so he said to me, "Well, I'll come home this evening. See what you can do about it." And that's the last I heard of it. And that made a big impression on me. I think maybe, hopefully, I don't know, I never asked him about it, but I assumed that he heard in my voice, you know, that I felt pretty bad about what had happened. And I think for him, probably I had a lesson enough. I wasn't going to do that again. And there was never any anger or anything, I think, I don't think there was, looking back, I don't think there was a need for it. So different ways of approaching a child who's done something. So here the Buddha comes, sits down and says, even so little is the monkhood of those who are not ashamed to tell the deliberate lie. Then the Blessed One threw away the little water that was left and asked Venerable Rahula, Rahula, do you see that little water that was thrown away? Yes, Venerable Sir. Even so, Rahula, those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie have thrown away their monkhood. Then the Blessed One turned the water vessel, the bowl, upside down and asked Rahula, Rahula, do you see this water vessel turned upside down? Yes, Venerable Sir. Even so, Rahula, those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie have turned the reckless ship upside down. I think he had to have told a lie to have gotten this kind of repeated admonition. Then the Buddha turned the water vessel right way up again and asked, do you see this hollow, empty water vessel? Yes, Venerable Sir. By this time, probably he's, yes, gulp. Even so, hollow and empty is the monkhood of those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie. So he's really kind of, driving the point home, but he doesn't stop there. And he says, suppose, Rahula, there were a royal tusker elephant with tusks as long as chariot poles, full grown in stature, high bred, and accustomed to battle. In battle, he would perform his task with his forefeet and his hind feet, with his forequarters and his hindquarters, with his head and his ears, with his tusks and his tail, yet he would keep back his trunk. Then his rider would think, this royal tusker elephant with tusks as long as chariot poles performs his task in battle with his forefeet and his hind feet, yet he keeps back his trunk. He has not yet given up his life. Then, when the royal tusker elephant performs his task in battle with his forefeet and his hind feet, with his forequarters and his hindquarters, with his head and his ears, with his tusks and his tail, and also with his trunk, then this rider would think, this royal tusker elephant with tusks as long as chariot poles performs his task in battle with his forefeet and his hind feet. He has given up his life. So I guess, you're willing to fight, give everything you have in the battle, willing to give up your life. Now, there is nothing this royal tusker elephant would not do. So this is a brave or foolish elephant, just willing to give everything over to the battle. Nothing that the elephant would not do. So too, Rahula, when one is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie, there is no evil, I say, that one would not do. Therefore, Rahula, you should train yourself. I will not utter a falsehood even as a joke. So this particular quote is kind of a famous quote in Buddhism, that when one is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie, there is no evil, I say, that one would not do. So it's a powerful statement. I don't know if it's true, but it's certainly a powerful statement to make. And the tremendous importance that the Buddha offered his son about the importance of being honest. It's one of the very touching things of my life. Many thought, retreats and what happens on retreats are so profound and beautiful to people. And there's many things I could list of all the wonderful things that happen. As a teacher, one of the wonderful things is the heightened sense of honesty that people have on retreat. And it's not, it happens time to time that someone comes to interview with me, then, we have this discussion about their practice, and they say something about their practice. And then I get a note, or they have to say, I have to come see you. Can I please come and see you, or something? And I say, I don't know what it's about. So I see them. And they come to apologize, because they didn't say, something was off what they said. They just, sometimes it's a little bit deliberate. They want to make a better impression than they, or they don't want to be as honest. Or sometimes it's just kind of inadvertent. But they feel so bad about it that they feel like they need, in order to continue on retreat, in order to keep opening the heart and mind the way that happens on retreat, they have to come and make amends and tell me and apologize. Generally, the things they have to tell me are pretty minor, you know, what they have, you know, what they have kind of missaid or something. But it's, sometimes it's so minor, I don't really feel there was a need. But it's so beautiful that someone wants to do that, that someone has a sensitivity and concern and this kind of sense of integrity. And the call for that integrity is much higher on retreat than often it is in daily life, because there's heightened sensitivity that people have about themselves and their hearts and what goes on there. Then the Buddha continues, and this is the teachings about action. What do you think, Rahula, what is the purpose of a mirror? For the purpose of reflection, Venerable Sir. So too, Rahula, an action with a body should not be done after repeated... So too, an action with a body, physical action, should be done after repeated reflection. An action by speech should be done after repeated reflection. An action by mind should be done by repeated reflection. So here, the Buddha refers to activity of the mind as an action. And some people don't have the same ethical sensitivity to what goes on in their mind as compared to what goes on in their body, what they do physically or what they do verbally. For in the teachings of Buddha, what you do with your mind is actually consequential. And part of the mindfulness, function of mindfulness practice, is to be a custodian of what goes on in your own mind. If you're filled with hatred in your mind, that activity, that action of, is not, you know, it's not a kind of, doesn't go into kind of a void. It's not like a non-event. It creates a conditioning, creates a habit, it creates momentum in the mind to be kind of acting, you know, having this mental activity of hate. And there's a whole series of, you know, mental actions we do, both healthy and unhealthy, that have affect us. And so for the Buddha, it's very important to be the custodian and caretaker of this wonderful thing we have, the mind, heart that we have. So that's why, so the Buddha says you have to reflect. And here the Buddha says the mirror is something you use. So the mirror here is your actions. You look at the actions that you're going to do, and you study them to see something about them. This is a little bit different than what I've seen in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, where they also use the simile of a mirror. But there they use the simile of the mirror as the innate, pure, luminous quality of the mind. That if you somehow remove all the clouds or all the dust from the mind, that there's the essential Buddha nature there that you can discover, and that you can rest in this mirror-like quality of the mind. In this early tradition, they don't posit the idea that there's some innate Buddha nature, innate purity of mind that you just have to kind of discover. But rather, what the focus here is rather look at your actions, study them, and take responsibility for them. And if you do that, then good results will happen, as opposed to ignore what you do, just focus on the innate quality of who you are. And that goes along a little bit with last week's talk, where the Buddha kept emphasizing not, you know, who you are, how you're born, and what's innate, but the actions, the activities, mind, body, and speech that that a person has. So, Rahula, when you wish to do an action with the body, you should reflect upon the same bodily action thus. Would this action that I wish to do with the body lead to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both? Is it an unwholesome bodily action with painful consequences, with painful results? When you reflect, if you know this action that I wish to do with the body would lead to my own affliction or to the affliction of others or to the affliction of both, it is an unwholesome bodily action with painful consequences, with painful results, then definitely you should not do such an action with the body. But when you reflect, if you know, this action that I wish to do with my body would not lead to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or the affliction of both. It is a wholesome bodily action with pleasant consequences, with pleasant results. Then you may do such an action with the body. So the assumption here is that it's possible for us to look at what we're planning to do, the actions we're going to take, and reflect on it, consider the consequences, consider what the impact is going to be. And if we feel it's going to harm someone, and interesting, it's harm others, harm ourselves, or harm both, self and others, which I take to be the kind of wider context that we're all in together. To consider that, to be conscientious about that, now to do things without some reflection and concern, what are the consequences of what I'm going to do? And the guideline for the consequences is whether it causes harm. Or if it doesn't cause harm, if it's for the benefit of others, or for yourself. And what's beautiful about this is that it's a relatively broad category for ethics, ethical evaluation. It's not laying down strict rules that you have to follow. All these many, you can come up with thousands and thousands of rules, lay down this is what you should do. And you would think also monastic life, that's what you do, you lay down all these rules. But he offers something very broadly, a principle by which use this principle to look at your behavior. What are the consequences of your behavior? And to the best of your ability, if you think that it's going to cause harm, don't do it. So the assumption here is that telling a lie is causing harm to oneself and to others and to both. And so he shouldn't have done that. And then he says the same thing so then he says, also, so that was before you do it. If you're going to do it, before you do it, reflect on what you're doing. And then he says, while you're doing an action with your body, you should reflect upon that same bodily action thus. Does this action I'm doing with the body lead to my own affliction, or the affliction of others, or the affliction of both? Is it unwholesome bodily action with painful consequence, with painful results? And then he goes on the same way. So here are the same instructions, but rather than before you do it, while you're doing it, it'd be good to have this mindful reflection of care and concern. What are the consequences? And so this is using mindfulness to something more than just being present in the moment for what's going on. It requires some imagination, some thinking ahead, the larger picture of what we're in, the context for which we're in. And the context we're in, as things develop, where is this leading? And while you're doing it, if it leads to harm, then stop doing it. If while you reflect and you see that it's not going to cause harm, if it's going to be beneficial, then the Buddha says you can continue doing it. So then there's, in the sequence of three, there's one more thing left. After you have done an action with the body, you should reflect upon the same bodily action thus. Did this action that I did with the body lead to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both? Was it an unwholesome bodily action with painful consequences, with painful results? When you reflect this way, if you know that this action I did with the body led to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or the affliction of both, it was an unwholesome bodily action with painful consequences and painful results, then you should confess such a bodily action, reveal it, and lay it open to a teacher or to a wise companion in the holy life. So if you look back and see I did something and it caused harm, then you need to do something. And even if you've only harmed yourself, and I like this because I think that over and over again you see the Buddha, his approach to the human being, to each of us is important, we're valuable. And the kind of self-respect that comes around being concerned about not harming oneself is a very important kind of self-respect. And so if you've harmed yourself, the respectful thing to do is not to say, well, no one noticed. no one noticed, and, it doesn't really matter. It only affected me. And it does matter that it affected you. You're important. And so you want to do something. Something's required. And so here, the suggestion is to go and confess. I'm not sure that the word confess here in the English translation is the best choice of an English word, because some people coming out of some religious traditions have rather powerful associations with the word confession that maybe are not what the Buddha had in mind. But go talk to someone. Go tell someone. So it says reveal it, lay it open to someone else. Something that's very significant to go and share with someone behavior you've done that you feel was off, when you've done, you've caused harm. For one thing, it relieves some of the pressure you have, of the guilt or the shame that might be there. But also, by speaking it, it's a way of more fully acknowledging what you've done. There's something about giving voice to what you've said in front of someone else who's a witness for it that makes it real in your own mind. So you might feel, yeah, I realize this was wrong, I shouldn't do this again. And that those thoughts have some value, but to actually say it to someone else, it's almost like a ritual of commitment. It's like, you know something? I did this, I don't feel good about it. It kind of sinks in deeper. You're probably less likely to do it again in the future if you've actually gone to tell someone else. Also, if you tell someone you respect, it's a wonderful thing, because if you have such a person who you can talk to, because then you kind of become a little bit accountable to them. Not that you ask them to be accountable, but they're keeping an eye on you. They'll run into you. They'll see you, and it's a little bit hard, to go back a second time and say, it's a protection from being more careful in the future. So then the Buddha goes through the same thing with same three steps before, during, and after for things that you speak, verbal actions. And then he goes through the same three steps with mental actions. And I've known people who have gone to find someone else and say, I want to confess, I want to apologize because I had these thoughts about you. That's quite something, You have to be careful how you do it, of course. You can cause more harm than good saying that, but it's also, it can be quite a beautiful thing, very profound thing to say, this is what I was thinking. And I realize now that I was wrong, and I feel bad about it, and I apologize for any way in which it might have spilled out or come out. So these are the teachings to a seven-year-old. Ethical teachings. this is probably someone at 7 years old, people maybe not ready to learn to meditate, not ready to learn some of the great sophisticated teachings of not-self and whatever, just a very basic idea. Just a very simple, basic idea. And this simple, basic idea might seem like, yes, it's good for a seven-year-old. I know this, But this principle of reflecting and looking at your actions of body, speech, and mind and the consequences of it is a very, very important movement, activity, practice for doing Buddhist spiritual practice right up to enlightenment. Because what you want to learn to do is to look and see, even when the mind is really peaceful and calm, are there subtle ways that the mind is operating still that are not really for your betterment, not really, a little bit kind of keeps a little bit of drag. So for example, you could be sitting in deep meditation, things are, you're blissed out, the mind is completely pure and wonderful. This is the best. That's good. And then you can feel there's this little movement of clinging to it. I want this. And if you're paying attention to your actions, your mental actions, and the consequences of it, you see, oh, this is a mental action, and that clinging to it is a kind of an affliction. It's a little bit, stressful, a little bit painful to have that. And so because of the training to pay attention to this, you let go. Or there might be a little bit like, look at me. I'm hot stuff. This is pretty cool, finally I've... And so there's a little bit of conceit involved. Or some people will have strong, wonderful experiences of meditation, and they'll have fear come up because it kind of changes their understanding of what's possible, and it's that can disrupt the status quo. And that fear then, it can be very subtle, that fear gets noticed and gets worked in. And each of these very subtle movements of the mind, and to pay attention, notice it, is a guide for finding our way forward into greater freedom. So this ability to use our actions, our activities, and body, speech, and mind as a mirror so we can become our own teachers is true on the gross ethical level, and it's also true on a very subtle level. And I believe that this is one of the hallmarks of this Buddhist tradition, is that we're trying to become our own teachers. We're trying to learn how to pay attention in such a way that we can find our own way. We can find the path for ourselves. We don't need a book to tell us what the path is. We don't need a teacher to tell us what the path is. What the books, the teachers, the teachings of Buddhism offer are the principles by which we can find that path. And one of the fundamental principles has to do with what causes suffering and what alleviates it, what causes happiness and what are the conditions for that happiness. It's quite a profound guide for finding a path, those two things. And it's good from the beginning of the path to the middle of the path to the end of the path. So to complete this text, the Buddha then ends, Rahula, whatever recluses, kind of spiritual seekers and Brahmins in the past purified their bodily action, their verbal action, and their mental action, all did so by repeatedly reflecting thus. Whatever recluses and Brahmins in the future will purify their bodily action, their verbal action, their mental action, all will do so by repeatedly reflecting thus. Whatever recluses and Brahmins in the present who are purifying their bodily action, their verbal action, and their mental action, all are doing so by repeatedly reflecting thus. Therefore, Rahula, you should train thus. We will purify our bodily action, our verbal action, our mental action, by repeatedly reflecting upon them. So in this text, when the Buddha begins his kind of admonition about lying, I imagine that Rahula gulped. Oops. And then the Buddha said it again, a different way. Oops. He's, you know, oops. Uh-oh. At the end of the sutra, it says, that is what the Blessed One said. Rahula was satisfied and delighted, in the Buddha's words. Isn't that a good ending? So, would you wish that you were, as a child, or maybe as an adult, were admonished in such a way that at the end of the admonishment, you were delighted and satisfied? And for a parent also, this is not just a kid who's supposed to do this, right? I've known parents who kind of expect to have high standards for their kids, but in demanding the high standards for the kids, they had lowered their own standards. You should not. You should not raise your voice. And so for parents also to reflect, what are the consequences? What are the of this action? Is it for my own? Is it for the benefit of others and for oneself? And can you, if you have to admonish your child, can you do it in such a way, by the time you're done, the child is delighted and satisfied?
It is a formulaic ending, however.
Shh. It takes my punchline away. He said it's a formulaic ending to most of these suttas. that the audience is delighted and satisfied. Maybe it is, but it's still a good story. So that's what I have. Do you have any time maybe for one or two comments or questions? So over here, is there a mic over there?
When we find situation where we're unable to predict the outcome of our actions with any accuracy, where should we go for guidance in how to decide how to act?
I think we should err on the side of caution. So, but where can we go for guidance? I suppose you could go to people who know, who are wise, who have experience with it. You could also go to the people who are going to be affected. And, you know, ask them, you know, I need to do something that's going to affect you, and I don't know the consequences. What do you think? And they might have some ideas. And if there's no one to talk to or ask for support help, then and it seems like it's important to do, then I think the second part is very important. You continue to reflect while you're doing it. Because there are times, you know, even when we think the consequences are pretty clear, the consequences aren't good, the situation can change in the middle of doing something. And so we have to kind of stay awake to the context and the changing what's going on, and then reflect then. And occasionally, you don't realize until after the fact. It seemed like it was a good idea in the beginning. It seemed like it was a good idea while you did it. But then, lo and behold, in ways that you never could have known, it caused harm for someone. Maybe it has to do with their particular situation. They have a unique background that made them particularly sensitive to something. And so, you know, there was no intention on your part, no thought that it was going to cause harm. And but someone was hurt anyway. And so then maybe it's good to reflect and maybe to make some amends for it, do something. Not necessarily feel guilty, but to... So this constant reflection, not as a burden to reflect, but rather something that's freeing and lightens us in the process. That's my thoughts. Yes, here in the front.
Is it on?
Yes.
You mentioned honesty getting a little higher during a retreat, and I felt that as well, and the relief and pleasure that I felt on a retreat with that feeling around me of honesty has been very profound, and it makes me realize that when honesty is not uppermost, there's a great deal of strain and stress involved, and to let that stress go is a delight.
Great. So. That's great. So the lesson of something like a retreat, hopefully there's other examples of this in people's lives, something that shows us a certain kind of purity, a certain kind of ease, a certain kind of freedom that, you know, is really felt in the heart in a powerful way, heightened sensitivity that feels really meaningful. And to have that experience on retreat or some other places and then have that as a reference point is a very useful reference point, because then you can understand sometimes what goes on in daily life that sometimes is invisible without that kind of reference point to highlight it. And so what Stephen says is that he's discovered that he doesn't have the same heightened sensitivity always in daily life, but the retreat has been very important because it shows him that when he's going to... I can't imagine you lying, but when you're...
Other people.
When he gets kind of, you know, a mile away from telling a lie, that he can notice that there's, you know, the strain and stress in the system then. And this is also very interesting to know, is the degree to which there's suffering, pain, stress, in the, you know, present when we're going to do something which is going to break an ethical precept or cause harm for someone. And then if that's there, strain, stress, if we're troubled in some way, can we care and tend for that and settle that away before we go and, you know, and then we might feel less motivated to do the thing that we were about to do. So this is a bit of Buddhist ethics. Some people don't like ethics because they find it cumbersome, but I think this is a very important part of the tradition, that this is a part of it. There's a trilogy. There's two other discourses in this collection. where the Buddha gives teachings to two more teachings to his son. The next one is when his son was a teenager, and that's when he does some teachings to the son around identity issues. I've heard that some teenagers have some issues around identity. And what's interesting here is that rather than, he gets some teaching around identity, but he offers him something, and what he offers him is meditation. And one of the really important roles of meditation practice is to provide a person with a sense of well-being that is more important or feels better than any identity you can have. And so that puts the whole issue of identity in a different context if you know something better to rest in. And then the last of these discourses is when the Rahula was about 20 years old, 21 years old, something like that, young adult. And the Buddha felt that his son was kind of ripe, mature in the spiritual life. And he took his son for a walk deep into the woods. Again, I find it very touching, beautiful place in a grove of trees called the kind of trees called the sal trees, which my understanding is are the kind of the Indian equivalent in majesty as the redwood trees here. So he took in this grove of these great trees, and they sat at the root of these trees, and he gave him these teachings on not self, and kind of almost like a guided meditation in how all these things which are not self, your body is not the self, your mind is not the self, your feelings not the self, your thought are not yourself. And as he gave him these teachings, his son's mind was liberated, was set free. So kind of like three stages in his son's practice through this. So, okay. Well, thank you very much. And we'll have tea now out there for those hang out, and we can talk. And then we'll set up, I think we'll set up in here for that community meeting we'll have about the retreat center. And when it's all set up and we're ready, we'll come in here and we'll have our meeting. Thank you.